Welcome back to the deep dive. Today I want to start with a scenario that I think is going to.
Gonna trigger some people.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
It is going to trigger a little bit of PTSD for every single person listening right now.
Uh-oh. Starting off light today, are we?
Always. No, but seriously, picture this. You are back in university, or maybe it's a certification you did for work last year. And you have the big exam coming up. You clear your schedule. You buy the energy drinks. You lock yourself in a room for 48 hours straight.
Oh, yeah, the classic masked practice session.
Exactly. You highlight the entire textbook. You make the flashcards. You cram. You are just a machine.
And you feel productive doing it too.
You do. And you walk into that exam room and you completely crush it. You get the A. You get the certificate. You feel like an absolute genius. But
You
then,
get 2 weeks.
yes, the fade. 2 weeks later, it's not just a fade, it's a total wipeout. Someone asks you a basic question about that topic you spent 48 hours obsessing over, and you just stare at them blankly.
It evaporates.
It's gone. It's like the file was corrupted and deleted from your hard drive.
And usually that is exactly when the self-loathing kicks in.
Yes. We think, oh, I have a terrible memory, or I'm just not smart enough to hold on to this complex stuff. We treat it as a personal failure.
Which is completely the wrong way to look at it.
Right. Because what if I told you, and what if the massive stack of sources we have today tells you that the problem isn't your brain at all? The problem is the schedule.
That is the key word right there, the schedule.
Because today we are diving deep into spaced repetition. And I want to be super clear right off the bat here. This is not just a study tip.
No, definitely not.
This isn't like try using a different color highlighter or listen to classical music. This is a fundamental hack for the human brain's storage system.
It really is. And I'm glad you used the word hack because it implies we're getting under the hood of the machine. Spaced repetition is a deeply evidence-based technique.
And it exploits specific psychological principles, right?
Exactly. It exploits the biological and psychological principles of how our minds actually encode long-term memory. It is the difference between treating your brain like a leaky bucket that you're frantically trying to refill,
Which is the cramming.
right, versus treating it like a muscle that you are systematically training over time.
And we really do have a fascinating stack of material today. We are going to cover history that goes back to the 1880s, which is wild to me.
Yeah, the timeline is pretty incredible.
We've got studies on sixth graders in Iowa from the 1930s. We have modern computer algorithms, neurosurgery training, and even applications for Alzheimer's patients.
The scope of where this applies is huge.
It is. So the mission for this deep dive is to explore how we as everyday learners can manipulate what is called the psychological spacing effect.
And if we get this right, the literature suggests we can increase the rate of learning dramatically and theoretically retain information indefinitely.
Indefinitely. I mean, that is a bold claim. So let's unpack this right away. What exactly is spaced repetition? If you had to define it for someone who has never heard the term, how do you break it down?
At its most basic level, spaced repetition is a learning technique where newly introduced or more difficult items are shown to you frequently, while older, easier items are shown less frequently.
So it acts almost like a filter.
It's a filter and a dynamic scheduler. Because in a traditional cramming session, you might review the same fact. Let's say you're learning the French word for apple. You might review it 20 times in 1 hour.
Right. Pom, pom, pom. I got it.
Exactly. And you feel good because by the 20th time, it feels incredibly easy.
But spaced repetition says no.
Right? It says, show it to me once, then wait.
Wait until when?
Wait until the memory starts to decay. Wait until it is almost completely gone. Then and only then do you show it again.
See, that sounds so risky to me. You are intentionally letting yourself almost forget.
That risk is exactly where the learning happens. The goal is to maximize the efficiency of your attention, because why waste time reviewing POM if you already know it?
You're just spinning your wheels.
Exactly. You should be spending that mental energy on the words you don't know. The system ensures you are always operating right at the edge of your ability.
Okay, so that's the what. But to truly understand the how and the why, we really have to go back in time. We need to talk about the grandfather of this whole field.
Yes, Hermann Ebbinghaus.
This guy sounds like a character. We are talking 1880s Germany, no computers, no fMRI scans, just a guy with a lot of time and a very specific curiosity about the brain.
Ebbinghaus is an absolute legend in psychology because he brought the rigorous scientific method to something as abstract as human memory.
Because before him, it was mostly philosophy, right?
Yeah, people thought about memory philosophically or qualitatively. Ebbinghaus wanted hard data, but he immediately ran into a problem.
What was the problem?
Associations. If he tried to study how well he could remember a poem or, say, a list of famous European cities, his previous knowledge would interfere with the data.
Because if he likes a poem, he naturally remembers it better.
Exactly. Or if he's actually visited the city, he remembers it better. That is not pure memory at work. That is association.
So he needed raw data. He needed data with zero pre-existing meaning.
Right. So he invented what he called nonsense syllables. Thousands of them. They were CVC trigrams, consonant, vowel, consonant.
So words like W-I-D?
Yes. W-I-D-Z-O-F-T-U-V. They meant absolutely nothing in German or English or any language.
So he just sat there and memorized lists of absolute gibberish.
For years. And he used himself as the only test subject. An N equals one study. He would memorize a list of these nonsense sounds until he could recite them perfectly.
Okay.
Then he would set a timer. Maybe 20 minutes. Maybe an hour. Maybe a full day. And then he would test himself again to see exactly how much he retained.
And what did he find? Because I have a feeling it wasn't great news for those of us who like to procrastinate.
No, it's pretty devastating, actually. He plotted all his results on a graph, and he created one of those famous concepts in all of cognitive psychology, the forgetting curve.
The forgetting curve? It honestly sounds like the title of a horror movie.
It basically is a horror movie if you're a student. It mathematically shows that memory loss isn't linear. It doesn't just slowly fade at a steady pace. It is exponential.
So the drop-off is fastest right at the beginning.
The steepest drop is immediately after you learn something. Within 20 minutes, you might lose 40% of what you literally just learned.
40% in 20 minutes.
Yeah. And within 24 hours, you have lost about 70%.
70% of the material in one day. That is staggering.
It's roughly that, yeah. And within a week, you are down to almost nothing. The curve levels off eventually, but the vast majority of the newly acquired information just falls off a cliff immediately.
Well, that explains so much. That explains exactly why you can sit in a brilliant lecture, understand everything perfectly, nod along feeling so smart.
And then you walk out the door.
Yeah, by the time you get to your car in the parking lot, the concepts are already getting hazy.
Exactly. Your brain is aggressively deleting that information because it hasn't been signaled that the information is actually important for your survival.
So Ebbinghaus maps out this disaster of a curve, but the genius is he didn't stop there. He actually figured out how to hack it.
He did. He discovered that if he reviewed the list of syllables just once, say 24 hours later, he didn't just remember it for that moment. The actual shape of the curve changed for the next time.
It flattened out.
Yes. The decay wasn't as steep the second time around. And if he reviewed it again 3 days later, the curve got even flatter.
Wow.
Each review acts like a breakwater against the tide of forgetting. Eventually, after enough spaced reviews, the curve becomes almost a completely flat line. You retain the information indefinitely.
So the real secret isn't just the repetition itself. It is the specific spacing of the repetition.
Precisely. If he had reviewed the list 10 times immediately after learning it, the curve wouldn't have changed much at all. It was the passage of time, the actual act of forgetting, that primed his brain to re-encode the memory much stronger.
And this brings us to a really fascinating concept in the research. It's called the effort principle.
This is critical to understand. And for most people, it is completely counterintuitive.
Right, because usually we think that if we're studying and it feels super easy, if we're just flying through the flashcards without thinking we're doing a great job, we feel like we're in the zone.
But the research tells us that easy is actually the enemy of retention.
Unpack that for me. Why is easy a bad thing when you're trying to learn?
Think about it in physical terms. If you go to the gym and you lift a weight that is as light as a feather, do you build any muscle?
Obviously not. You need resistance. You need to strain the muscle fibers to get them to rebuild stronger.
Memory works the exact same way. The effort principle basically states that the more effort required to retrieve a memory, the greater the strengthening of that memory trace will be.
So that moment of sheer panic, that moment when I'm staring at a flashcard and I know the answer, but I'm scrunching up my face and sweating a little bit, digging through my brain, that struggle is the learning.
That struggle is the magic. That is your brain physically strengthening the neural pathway to that specific piece of information. When you cram or when you just casually reread a highlighted textbook, you aren't struggling at all. You're just recognizing.
Recognition versus recall.
It is a huge difference. Recognition is simply saying, oh, yeah, I've seen that before. Recall is saying, I have to reconstruct this entire concept from scratch.
I see.
Spaced repetition forces you to rely on active recall right at the exact moment when it's hardest, right before you forget it entirely.
It's almost like waiting until a path in the jungle has almost grown over with thick vines and then forcing yourself to hack your way through it all over again. And that act of hacking actually widens the path permanently.
That is a perfect analogy. Because if you just walk back and forth on a completely clear path all day, you aren't doing any real work. You have to let the jungle grow back a bit.
Now, digging into the research a bit more, there seems to be a debate among the experts on how exactly to schedule this jungle hacking. We have uniform intervals versus expanding intervals. What is the distinction there?
So the classic model, the one that Ebbinghaus hinted at, and later researchers like Landauer and Bjork really formalized in the 70s, is expanding intervals.
Okay.
This means the gaps between your reviews get progressively bigger and bigger. So you review a fact after one day, then maybe 3 days, then 7 days, then 21 days.
Which makes total sense logically, because as the memory gets stronger and the curve flattens, I need to check on it less often.
Exactly. Landauer and Bjork did a very famous study in 1978 on name face association, and they found that expanding the intervals was highly effective for long-term retention.
It's highly efficient, too.
Right, it's efficient.
No.
You don't want to be reviewing a simple fact like cat equals gato every single day for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Eventually, you want to push that review out to once a year or even longer.
But there is a counter argument to this expanding method.
There is. Some more recent meta-analyses have looked at the data and suggested that uniform spacing where the gap stays exactly the same, say, reviewing every 5 days, might work just as well in certain contexts.
Why would a uniform gap be better?
Simplicity, for one thing. It's easier to schedule, but more importantly, for very complex or difficult material, expanding the interval too quickly can actually be dangerous.
Oh, because you forget it before the next review.
Right. If you jump from a one-week interval to a one-month interval on a highly complex physics equation, you might completely lose it. The jungle might have grown back entirely too thick.
You lost the path entirely and have to start over.
Exactly. So uniform spacing keeps that path clear for the really tough stuff. But generally speaking, the expert consensus today is that while expanding intervals are the gold standard for pure efficiency, the absolute most important factor is simply the spacing itself.
Just don't do it all at once.
Exactly. Whether the interval expands or stays the same, the critical move is stepping away from the material and coming back later. Don't mass your practice, space it out.
Okay, so we have the hard science here. We have the forgetting curve mathematically proven in the 1880s. We understand the biology of the effort principle. You would really think, knowing all this, that our entire modern education system would be built around this. I mean, schools from kindergarten to med school should just be spaced repetition factories.
You would certainly think so. It seems incredibly obvious in hindsight.
But looking at the history section of our source material, it's actually a story of massive missed opportunities. It's honestly kind of tragic.
It really is a bit of a tragedy in the field of educational psychology. We had the answer, and we largely ignored it for decades.
Let's talk about C.A. Mace.
Right. So we jump forward from Ebbinghaus to 1932. C.A. Mace writes a very influential book called The Psychology of Study. And he isn't vague about this concept at all. He explicitly proposes a distributed study schedule for students.
He literally wrote out a formula, right?
He did. He proposed review intervals of 1 day, 2 days, 4 days, 8 days. He basically laid out the exact blueprint for an algorithmic approach to studying long before personal computers even existed.
That was 1932. Just pen and paper. And then a few years later, we get actual hard proof on a massive scale. Tell me about the lost study of 1939.
This is the work of a researcher named H.F. Spitzer, and the scale of his study is mind-blowing, especially for the time. He worked with 3,600 sixth grade students across the state of Iowa.
3,600 kids. That is a massive sample size, even by today's standards. Doing that without computers sounds like a nightmare.
It was a huge logistical feat. He was testing their retention of science facts. He divided these thousands of students into different groups. Some groups studied traditionally cramming the material. Other groups used a spaced testing schedule.
Meaning they were tested on the material at specific intervals without even restudying it.
Exactly, just retrieving it under test conditions.
And what was the result?
It was completely unequivocal. The spaced groups significantly outperformed the traditional groups. Spitzer proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that simply testing the students at spaced intervals stopped the forgetting curve dead in its tracks.
So we have the solid theory from Mace. We have the massive, undeniable proof from Spitzer. It's 1939. This should have radically changed everything about how we run schools.
And yet there was just silence.
What happened? How does something like that get buried?
The field of psychology just went quiet on memory. You really have to remember the academic context of the time. Behaviorism was completely taking over the field. B.F. Skinner. Rats in puzzle boxes. Pigeons pecking buttons.
Ah, stimulus and response.
Right. The entire focus of the scientific community shifted to operant conditioning rewards and punishments. They stopped caring about the internal cognitive architecture of memory. The whole idea of mental curves and decay rates just fell completely out of fashion.
So millions of students went through school in the 40s, 50s, and 60s thinking they were stupid because they kept forgetting things, while the actual solution was literally sitting in an academic journal on a dusty shelf.
Effectively, yes. It really highlights the massive gap that often exists between academic research and everyday practice. It wasn't until the late 60s that the cognitive revolution happened and brought memory back into focus.
And it came back through a very practical side door, which is language learning. I think a lot of our listeners will immediately recognize the name Pimsleur.
Paul Pimsleur, yes.
Yeah. If you have ever tried to learn Spanish or French in your car on a CD or an app, you've probably used his method, the classic listen and repeat.
Pimsleur was a true pioneer, because he took this highly abstract psychological theory and turned it into a rigid, scalable commercial product. In 1967, he published a paper called A Memory Schedule, and the precision of his schedule is amazing.
I am looking at the list here in the notes right now. It is incredibly specific. It starts with a review interval of 5 seconds.
Yes, 5 seconds. Pimsleur deeply understood that the initial memory decay happens almost instantly. It's stored in what we call the phonological loop of working memory.
So it's super fragile.
Very fragile. You hear a new sound, a brand new foreign word, and if you don't repeat it within roughly 5 seconds, it is gone.
So you repeat it at 5 seconds, then what?
Then 25 seconds, then 2 minutes, then 10 minutes, 1 hour, 5 hours, 1 day, 5 days, 25 days, 4 months, 2 years.
That is the definition of exponential growth.
He called it graduated interval recall.
Oh.
He was functionally building a bridge from that fleeting first second of hearing a word all the way out to permanent lifelong storage. He proved that you could literally engineer a memory.
It's amazing to see it codified mathematically like that, but I want to pivot a bit here because when we think of Pimsleur and when we think of flashcards generally, we usually think of simple vocabulary. We think of basic facts. Chat means cat. The capital of France is Paris.
Right, semantic memory. Rote facts.
Exactly. But the sources we are looking at today suggest that spaced repetition is way more powerful than just memorizing simple lists. It's not just for trivia. Let's talk about mathematics.
This is a huge development in the literature. Traditionally, educators thought, okay, spaced repetition is great for memorization. But math is about true understanding. It's about process and logic. You don't memorize math, you do math.
Right. You don't just memorize y equals mx plus b. You have to actually understand how to graph the line on a plane.
Exactly. But a major study by Pashler, Rohrer, Sapieha, and Carpenter challenged that entire distinction. They look at how spaced repetition affects a student's ability to actually solve complex math problems.
And this brings up the concept of interleaving, right?
Yes. Interleaving is crucial here. Usually math textbooks use a technique called blocking. You learn chapter 4, which is quadratic equations. Then you sit down and do 50 quadratic equations in a row for homework.
Which feels super efficient. You get to a great rhythm.
But that rhythm is actually a cognitive trap.
Mm-hmm.
By the fifth problem, you aren't really thinking anymore. You're just blindly following a recipe. You know the solution involves a quadratic equation simply because you are currently in the quadratic equation chapter.
You aren't diagnosing the problem. You're just on autopilot.
Correct. But if you use spaced repetition combined with interleaving, you mix everything up. You do one quadratic equation. Then the next problem is a geometry question from last week. Then a linear equation from last month.
See, that sounds incredibly annoying for the student.
Oh, it is highly annoying. It goes right back to that desirable difficulty we talked about.
Yeah.
Every single time you look at a new problem, you first have to ask yourself, wait, what kind of problem is this? Which tool do I pull out of my mental toolbox?
So the diagnosis is part of the practice.
Yes. That decision process, that active retrieval of the correct strategy, is exactly what reinforces the deep learning.
And the studies show that this actually worked for math.
It worked incredibly well. The spaced and interleaved group didn't just remember the core formulas better. They were significantly better at applying the underlying principles to brand new unseen problems.
But there is a catch here, isn't there? The notes specifically mention the role of feedback.
Yes. For this to work in mathematics, or really any complex application, you absolutely need immediate feedback. If you struggle with a difficult problem, get it completely wrong, and don't know why you got it wrong, you might actually reinforce the error.
Right. You need that aha moment immediately after the struggle to correct the path.
Exactly. The intense struggle opens up the brain's receptivity, and the immediate feedback deposits the correct information into that open slot.
Okay, so math is one thing. That makes sense. But this next application in our sources actually gave me pause. It feels almost too high stakes. We are talking about neurosurgery.
This is from a fascinating study by Robertson and colleagues, published very recently in 2023.
We are literally talking about training medical residents to operate on human brains.
We are. And obviously, proficiency in this field is completely non-negotiable. The study looked at a complex simulation module for neurosurgery training. One group of residents trained using traditional methods, likely mass practice doing the surgical simulation over and over in a single block.
And the other group?
The other group used a spaced repetition schedule for the simulation.
And what were the results?
The surgical residents who used the spaced repetition module showed significant measurable improvements in objective performance metrics. They were tangibly better at performing complex surgical procedures.
That is wild to me. So we aren't just talking about remembering the Latin name of a specific cranial nerve. We are talking about the physical procedural skill of the surgery itself.
That is exactly the implication. It strongly suggests that spaced repetition can facilitate the acquisition of complex procedural knowledge. Think about it carefully. A surgery is essentially a sequence of steps. A sequence of high-level decisions and precise physical movements.
It's intense muscle memory.
Exactly. Strengthening the reliable recall of those procedural steps and the physical execution of them through calculated spacing leads to much better performance. It seems that the rest periods in spaced repetition actually allow the brain to quietly consolidate those physical motor patterns.
Like it's working in the background.
Yes. It might even be myelinating those specific neural pathways more effectively than just hammering away at the simulation for 4 hours straight.
It's definitely comforting in a way to know that surgeons are actively finding better ways to learn how to cut into us. But I want to move to the completely opposite end of the spectrum now. We've talked about high-performance learning in elite neurosurgery, but what about when memory fundamentally starts to fail? The sources also discuss applications for Alzheimer's and dementia.
This is, to me, the most poignant and beautiful application of this entire science. We have groundbreaking work from Camp in 1989, Small in 2012, and Jolden in 2003. They specifically looked at using spaced retrieval training for people with genuine severe memory impairments.
There is a specific story detailed in the notes about a grandmother and a photo that I found really touching.
Yes, this is from the 2003 Jolden study. They had a professional caregiver train an older woman who was suffering from Alzheimer's. The goal was incredibly simple, but profoundly important. They wanted to train her to associate a name with a photo of her grandchild that was hanging on the refrigerator.
Something that most of us just take completely for granted, but for her, that reality was disappearing.
Exactly. Now, they used a very specific modified version of spaced repetition here. It's called spaced retrieval training combined with errorless learning.
How is errorless learning different from what we've discussed?
Well, normally, as we establish, we want you to struggle. We want you to maybe get it wrong so you feel that desirable difficulty.
Yeah.
But for an Alzheimer's, patient failure is deeply discouraging. It creates severe anxiety and confusion.
You're right, that makes sense.
So they intentionally do not let her fail.
How do they actually manage that in practice?
The caregiver points to the photo and says, "This is your grandson, David. Who is this?" She replies, "David." Then they wait just 5 brief seconds. "Who is this?" "David." If she gets it right, they expand the interval to 20 seconds.
But what if she hesitates?
If she hesitates even for a second, they jump in immediately. They give her the correct name before she can guess and get it wrong. They keep the success rate artificially high, but they still rigorously stretch that time interval.
And did this actually work for her?
After the training protocol, this woman was able to independently recall the name of her grandchild 5 full days later.
5 days? That's incredible.
For someone battling Alzheimer's, retaining a brand new piece of information, or consciously re-retaining an old one for 5 whole days, is an absolute mountain. It is a huge victory.
And the true significance isn't just about memorizing a sequence of letters for a name. It is about human connection.
It absolutely is. It's about maintaining a patient's dignity. It's about maintaining their anchor to reality and to their loved ones. The broader research shows this technique helps with name face association, remembering to perform daily tasks like locking a door or using a walker, or even just remembering their room number in a care facility.
It gives them agency.
Yes, it keeps the brain actively engaged and can improve their daily quality of life significantly.
It really just shows that this fundamental mechanism, the psychological spacing effect, is so deeply ingrained in how our physical brains work that it remains highly effective even when the physical brain is actively damaged.
That's very true.
It's like the computer's operating system is incredibly glitchy, but this one core line of code just keeps running perfectly.
That is a beautiful way to put it. It taps into something very, very deep in our biological wiring.
Okay, so we have firmly established that this works. It works for sixth graders in Iowa. It works for elite neurosurgeons. It works for dementia patients. The big practical question for you and me now is, how do we actually implement it? Because I definitely don't have a team of researchers following me around my house with a stopwatch.
Right, you need a practical system.
Yeah.
And broadly looking at the history in our notes, we can break the implementation down into three distinct eras: the analog era, the audio era, and the digital era.
Let's start with the analog era, the famous shoebox method.
Yes, the Leitner system. Mm-hmm. Named after Sebastian Leitner, who was a German science journalist.
Yeah.
He really popularized this method for everyday people in the 1970s. He wrote a hugely popular book called So Learnt Man Learnin', which translates to How to Learn to Learn.
That is a great title. Very meta.
It is. And he proposed a physical learning box. Imagine a long shoebox physically divided into five separate sections.
Okay, I'm visualizing the box.
All of your brand new flashcards start in box one at the front. These are the cards you have to review every single day. The daily grind.
The danger zone where you don't know anything yet.
Exactly. Now, let's say you pick up a card from box one, you test yourself, and you get it right. You successfully recalled it. That card graduates and moves back to box two.
And box two gets reviewed less often.
Yes. You might only check box two every 3 days. If you get it right when you review box two, it graduates to box three, which is maybe checked every week. Then box four is every 2 weeks. Then finally, box five is every month.
So visually, as you securely learn the material, the physical card moves further and further away from your daily attention.
Right. It perfectly mirrors the expanding interval concept. But here is the brilliant mechanical rule that actually makes it work. The penalty.
What is the penalty?
Yeah. If you pick up a card from box four, something you theoretically haven't seen in 2 weeks, and you draw a blank, you realize you've forgotten it. What do you think happens to that card?
Does it just step back to box three?
No. It goes all the way back to the very front to box one.
Ouch. Back to start. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Straight back to the daily grind.
Yeah.
It severely penalizes mistakes by forcing you to review that forgotten material much more aggressively. It's honestly like a video game where you lose all your checkpoint progress on that specific item if you die.
It sounds kind of brutal.
It is brutal, but that strict penalty ensures that you never ever fool yourself into thinking you know something you don't. Hmm. If you forgot it, you clearly need to review it more often. It is a brilliant physical representation of a complex spacing algorithm.
I do really like the tactile nature of that. It physically gamifies the learning process, but obviously managing five distinct boxes and potentially thousands of little paper cards sounds like an absolute administrative nightmare. You would probably spend more time sorting the paper than actually studying.
It is highly time intensive to manage, and that is exactly why the digital revolution completely changed the game for spaced repetition.
Enter the personal computer.
Yes. In the 1980s, we start seeing the first specialized software that can handle all the complex scheduling mathematics for you in the background. You don't need physical shoeboxes anymore. You just need a database.
And this is where we get the really big names in the current field. Things like SuperMemo and Anki.
SuperMemo is really the original pioneer here. It was developed by a Polish researcher named Piotr Wozniak. He's widely considered the godfather of the modern algorithmic approach to memory.
He wrote the actual code.
Yes, he developed a progressive series of sophisticated algorithms, starting with SM2, all the way up to SM18, that attempt to mathematically optimize the exact review interval for every single card individually based on your performance.
But how does the computer actually know when I'm about to forget something? They can't read my mind or scan my brain.
It asks you. This introduces the crucial concept of confidence-based repetition. When you flip a digital flashcard in a popular app like Anki, you don't just mark it as strictly right or wrong, you actually rate your subjective confidence in your answer, usually on a scale of 1 to 4. The buttons usually say, again, hard, good, and easy.
So hitting again means I failed completely and drew a blank. Hitting easy means I knew it instantly without thinking.
Exactly. And that specific button press determines the entire mathematical future of that card. If you rate it easy, the algorithm applies a large multiplier. It says, okay, you knew this after 5 days with zero effort. Let's push it way out. Let's try 15 days next time.
But if I hit the hard button?
The algorithm said, whoa, okay, you barely got that one. We get close to the forgetting threshold. Let's rein it in and see it again in maybe 6 days instead of 15. It dynamically adjusts the forgetting curve specifically for your unique brain and specifically for that one individual fact.
So it's effectively tailoring thousands of distinct forgetting curves simultaneously.
Yes. It allows for truly massive scaling of knowledge. You can literally have 10,000 cards in your active deck. Medical students and language learners do this all the time, and the software ensures you only spend your valuable time today reviewing the 50 specific cards you are statistically about to forget.
That is the ultimate definition of efficiency.
It really is. And the modern algorithms are getting even more sophisticated as we speak. There was a mention in our source notes of a new system called FSRS, which stands for Free Spaced Repetition Scheduler.
FSRS, that sounds very high-tech.
It is extremely high-tech. It essentially uses machine learning and complex neural networks. Instead of relying on a static mathematical formula like the older SuperMemo models, FSRS actively analyzes your entire personal history of past reviews to continuously predict your exact probability of recall with incredible accuracy.
So it learns how you learn.
Exactly. It's basically using AI to constantly remodel your personal memory decay rate in real time.
It's almost like having an elite personal trainer for your hippocampus, who knows exactly how strong every single microscopic muscle fiber is at any given moment.
That is precisely what it is doing.
Okay, so we have the digital tools. We clearly understand the underlying science. What does this all fundamentally mean for us as everyday learners? Because it really feels like most of us are still deeply stuck in that read the textbook three times with a highlighter mindset.
We absolutely are. And I think the single biggest takeaway here, beyond simply telling people to go use flashcard apps, is shifting our understanding of the testing effect.
The testing effect. Tell me more about that.
In traditional education, we tend to think of a test purely as an evaluation tool, a way to measure what you have already learned. You study the material and then you take a test to see if the studying worked. The test is just the final judgment.
Right. The test is the scary ending to the process.
But the rigorous science of spaced repetition shows us that the very act of testing is actually the learning itself. Actively retrieving the hidden information, pulling it out of your brain under pressure, is exactly what physically strengthens the neural connection.
Oh, wow.
Testing shouldn't just be the end of the learning process. It should be the primary engine of the process itself.
So instead of just reading the chapter again and again, you should close the book, stare at the wall, and try to explain the concept out loud to an empty room. Or actively test yourself with a question.
Yes. Active recall. That is the engine that drives true learning. The spacing algorithm just optimizes the fuel efficiency of that engine. If you are merely reading, you are being passive. If you are testing yourself, you are being active.
And it really completely changes the way you look at failure, too. In this algorithmic model, getting a question wrong isn't a bad thing at all. It's just a neutral data point for the system.
Exactly. It removes all the heavy emotional baggage from forgetting. Forgetting isn't a character flaw or a sign of low intelligence. It is just a biological signal that the review interval was scheduled slightly too long. The digital algorithm sees the failure and simply says, okay, noted. We will review this item a little sooner next time.
I love that perspective. Forgetting isn't a character flaw. It's literally just biology.
It's just inputs and outputs in the neural network.
So as we start to wrap up this deep dive today, I am really left with this lingering sense that we as a society are leaving so much human potential on the table by not integrating this universally. But I also have a big question about where this is all ultimately going, because we talked about these algorithms getting better and better with machine learning.
Right. The AI integration is moving fast.
And the research clearly suggests the absolute best study schedule is highly learner dependent. My brain's decay rate is completely different from your brain's decay rate. And the FSRS algorithm knows that.
Absolutely. It maps your unique topography.
So here is my provocative closing thought for the day. Are we inevitably moving toward a future where education is entirely algorithmic? I mean, imagine a world where a black box computer program decides the exact second you need to review a specific fact in order to keep it in your brain forever.
It is a genuinely fascinating, slightly dystopian, but also incredibly utopian possibility to think about.
Right. It's utopian because we could theoretically learn absolutely anything efficiently. We could master quantum physics or Mandarin. But it's somewhat dystopian because, well, do we lose our own agency? Do we lose control of our own minds?
That's the core philosophical issue. If we completely offload the management and scheduling of our memory to an AI system, do we free up our biological brains for much higher level creative thinking? Or do we just become entirely dependent on the machine to literally know what we know?
It's exactly like using GPS on our phones. I honestly don't know how to navigate my own city anymore because the little blue dot just tells me where to turn. Will I eventually lose the basic cognitive ability to manage my own learning process if the Anki algorithm does all the heavy lifting for me?
That is the ultimate question we have to face. We might all eventually become what you could call cyborg learners. But frankly, if plugging into that cyborg system means I can effortlessly speak 5 languages and easily perform complex neurosurgery, maybe it's actually worth the trade-off.
That is a very fair point. Honestly, looking at my old college transcripts, I think I would probably take the trade in a heartbeat.
I think I would be right there with you.
Well, on that note, I think I have some digital flashcards to go make. I need to actively reinforce my memory of this fascinating conversation before the forgetting curve kicks in and I lose 40% of it.
You've got about 20 minutes before that steep drop-off begins, so you better get to it.
I better hurry. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We will see you next time.
See you next time.